KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Robert Francis Prevost is the first American Pope, and in his first words as Leo XIV, he said the Catholic Church must build bridges. How might he lead? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Coming up, we meet a priest who studied with Pope Leo and then worked with him in Peru. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldil. Also, the Department of Transportation has a plan to upgrade old air traffic technology. How much will it cost? President Trump appoints Fox News host Jeanine Pirro to be the interim federal prosecutor in Washington, D.C. It's Friday, May 9th. On this day in 1754, the Pennsylvania Gazette published the first American political cartoon, a divided snake critiquing disunity among the colonies. The caption, "Join or Die." The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is now saying an 80% tariff on imported Chinese goods, quote, seems right. Writing online, Trump says it's up to Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who's meeting Chinese economic officials this weekend. Businesses in the United Kingdom are trying to figure out what a new U.S.-UK trade deal means for them. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London.
Stocks are up in British car companies Rolls-Royce and Aston Martin after officials said this deal cuts U.S. tariffs on most British cars. They said it also eliminates tariffs completely for British steel and aluminum and cuts U.K. tariffs on ethanol from the U.S. But President Trump said other details are still being written up. For example, it's unclear whether U.S. e-commerce firms like Amazon will get a break from the U.K. digital services tax. Speaking at a conference in Iceland, the head of the UK's central bank calls the deal good news, but points out tariffs are still higher than before Trump took office. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says that the migrant illegally deported to El Salvador in March will not be coming back to the U.S. Noem spoke to a Senate panel yesterday about the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. The U.S. Supreme Court has told the Trump administration to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return. Maryland Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen questioned Noem about his case.
Simple question. Are you taking any action to facilitate his return, or are you not?
This administration is following and complying with all federal court orders to make sure that we...
So you are... So because the court ordered that you facilitate his return, so you are facilitating his return.
Sir, Senator, thank you for the question, but what I would tell you is that we are following court orders and that your advocacy for a known terrorist is alarming to me.
Madam Secretary...
It's alarming to me because he's a human smuggler.
Madam Secretary, I'm going to have to reclaim
it. And a terrorist, and he's not a U.S. citizen.
Democrats say the issue is not about citizenship. It's that Abrego Garcia was denied due process as required by the Constitution. Newly elected Pope Leo XIV celebrated his first public mass as head of the Catholic Church this morning. NPR's Jason DeRose reports from Rome.
The Bible readings for the mass in the Sistine Chapel were in English, Spanish, and Latin, two of them read by women. Pope Leo began his homily in English before switching to Italian.
I invite you to recognize the marvels that the Lord has done, the blessings that the Lord continues to pour out upon all of us.
He preached on the story from the Gospel of Matthew, in which Jesus tells the disciple Peter that he will build his church upon him, the rock. The sermon went on to warn of the dangers of practical atheism, the idea that one leads one's life without concern about God. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
You're listening to NPR News. The Defense Department is swiftly moving to kick transgender people out of the U.S. military. This follows a ruling from the Supreme Court this week, allowing Trump's executive order to remove transgender service people to proceed, while the case is being challenged in lower courts. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth released a video on X, saying people who are known to be trans will be removed. He also said that people who, quote, exhibit symptoms of gender dysphoria will also be removed. Those who don't go voluntarily will be forced out. State lawmakers in Maine are under pressure from the White House to ban transgender athletes from girls' and women's sports. From Maine Public, Maddie Smith has more.
Republicans in the Democratic-controlled legislature are seeking the ban. Most of the bills take aim at the Maine Human Rights Act. and gender identity protections that have existed for years but have recently garnered national attention. GOP lawmakers say those protections are unfair to female athletes and violate the spirit of Title IX, a 1972 law meant to expand opportunities for women. Most Democrats argue the ban would further harm the already vulnerable transgender community. Maine's Governor Janet Mills clashed with President Trump over the topic during a meeting of governors at the White House. Maine is now the focus of a lawsuit by the Trump administration, which is attempting to pull Maine's $250 million in federal education funding. For NPR News, I'm Maddie Smith in Portland, Maine.
Weather forecasters say the Los Angeles area will get a mini heat wave this weekend. They warn that temperatures could rise to the high 90s through Sunday. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
On a Friday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. The first American pope in history celebrated his first Mass as pontiff today.
You have called me to carry that cross and to be blessed with that mission. And I know I can rely on each and every one of you to walk with me as we continue as a church, as a community of friends of Jesus, as believers, to announce the good news, to announce the gospel.
Leo XIV, who was born Robert Prevost, addressed the cardinals who elected him. Dressed in white and gold vestments, he spoke in the Sistine Chapel beneath Michelangelo's fresco, The Last Judgment. Leo was named just yesterday. Tens of thousands of people packed into St. Peter's Square to greet the new pontiff as he emerged onto the balcony of the Basilica. NPR senior producer Sarah Ventry and international correspondent Ruth Sherlock were there and take us through the surprising and historic day.
In the moments before the white smoke came, there were prayers in St. Peter's Square. Prayers in all languages, from priests, monks, nuns, and other faithful, like these women from Bangladesh. All with their own private hopes for who should become the new leader of the Catholic Church. And then, just after 6 p.m. in Italy, there it was.
The bells of St. Peter's Square are tolling. White smoke is billowing out of the chimney of the Sistine Chapel. It means a new pope, a new era for the Catholic Church.
In the crowd, there's so much anticipation and celebration. The Vatican Swiss Guards, in their helmets with red plumes, parade through St. Peter's Square. People cry, long live the Pope.
Everyone has come out to witness this moment in history. And here we go, The announcement is about to be made.
Habemus Papam. We have a Pope.
Cardinalem Prévost.
There's surprise at first, and a little confusion. People scramble on their phones to understand who this is. But there's no internet, almost no phone data, one woman says. Gradually the name Robert Prévost is passed through the crowd. Leo XIV, the United States of America's first pope. Peace be with you all, are his opening words.
Fratelli, sorelle carissimi.
His speech carries echoes of the papacy of his predecessor Francis's focus on a global church. He wishes peace to, quote, all of the people all over the earth.
A tutti i popoli, a tutta la terra, la pace sia con voi.
I'm so proud of our church. I'm so proud of the Midwest. I'm so proud of all of our priests and deacons and bishops and cardinals that serve the church in the U.S. So very, very happy.
Kimberly Mandelko is from Minneapolis. She's interrupted by an Italian passerby.
Bad news on American Pope. Very bad news. After Trump, all the American Pope.
He walks away before we can get his name, but he's worried about having an American Pope in the era of President Trump, viewed by some as a disruptor. But maybe this is why the world needs an American Pope, Mandelko says.
But maybe that's a good thing. American Pope with Trump. I think because he knows our system, being an American, he knows democracy. I think he knows how to talk to President Trump and to hopefully get him to back down.
Just one of the countless expectations, thoughts, and hopes from Catholics all around the world as they wait to learn more about their new Pope. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, St. Peter's Square in Vatican City.
During his initial remarks yesterday, the new pope made special mention of Chiclayo, a city where he served in Peru. So we called somebody there. Janina Sessa is the former director of a Catholic charity in Chiclayo.
We saw a bishop who put on a helmet, boots, and went out to meet people. Very close, very, very humble with everyone, from those who held important positions to the most humble of people.
He needed the helmet and boots when responding to disasters such as flooding. He also tried to help people during a dengue fever outbreak and the pandemic.
During the pandemic, there was an oxygen shortage in Chiclayo. Thanks to his efforts, we were able to buy not one but two oxygen plants. That saved many lives. The oxygen was made available free of charge to anyone who needed it, especially the most vulnerable.
Sessa says the community that he once led in Peru will continue to try to give the Pope a little oxygen.
Now he can count on our prayers because it will also be a difficult road ahead for him.
Well, let's talk about that road ahead with another person from Robert Prévost's past, Reverend William Lego of St. Turibius Parish in Chicago, who has known the Pope since sixth grade. They attended high school together, went to seminary and to Villanova University together, and even after that were together for a time. Reverend Lego, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You must have known him before he ever said, I want to be a priest. What was he like then?
Well, I remember we met in sixth grade. It was a process where at the time religious orders and stuff would invite young men to their seminaries. It was a whole different system than we have today. And so we were together for a summer. So we did stuff like we did sports, we studied, they talked about the priesthood. So it was like a big basic introduction. And then when we got to high school, I know a lot of us, it was a very good education for a very good price at the time. Mm-hmm. And our parents were in favor of that. But also, all of us came from families that were very, what to call it, religious or very much united with their faith and practiced their faith. You know, so he was a normal kid. I mean, he was always studious. He was very intelligent. He always was one of the ones who kept us kind of focused on sometimes bigger issues and things. I hope that I'm making myself clear on that.
I think you're saying that he had the big strategic thoughts, whereas other people maybe were
at times. Yeah, at times. And he was also centered on helping people. He was always doing stuff for, you know, always very serviceable, as they say, very willing to do things.
Now, I want people to know, you told me a few minutes ago that you were with him in the novitiate, if I'm saying that correctly, a period of about a year where in your order you're told to think about this. Do you really want to spend your life doing this? Do you recall what pushed him in the direction that he ultimately went?
You know, a little bit. I mean, we were in Immaculate Conception, St. Henry Parish in St. Louis University, which is in one of the poorer parts of St. Louis. Our order had a parish there. So during that time, not only did we reflect on, is God calling us to continue this journey to become Augustinians and Augustinian priests later on, but also being in that parish, we had the opportunity to live with and work with the poor. And I think that honed for him his calling, for lack of a better term, on if we continue, it's going to be working with the poor. It's going to be working with those who need help or who need accompaniment, as they say.
So I'm thinking about a pope from Chicago, a pope from Villanova, a pope who lived in St. Louis among the poor. How do you reflect on the idea of an American as pope?
Well, if we're part of a universal church, which we are, my always thought is, but, well, why not? If the church is open to the Spirit will look for, at the time, probably the best or candidate to lead the church. And our role as Catholics throughout the world is, once that expression of the Spirit becomes public, like it did yesterday for naming Cardinal Prevost as Pope, well, then our next journey is we begin to work together and continue to discover how the Spirit is alive in the world. And that goes in very much with the Augustinian, as I understand it. We call people into communion. We call people into community. We help them live and identify and put into practice their faith in ways that help them feel whole, help them live the gospel message in their lives.
Let me ask, though, Silvia Poggioli, our great correspondent in Rome, said that for the longest time it was considered taboo to have an American because America was already so powerful in so many other ways. Robert Barron, who is a bishop from Minnesota, spoke to CBS News before the announcement, and he said, he quoted a cardinal who once said that until America goes into political decline, there won't be an American pope because America is too powerful. Do you think the church is saying something by choosing an American?
I'm not sure. I mean, I know, you know, that's a very interesting statement that the bishop had made. And I would like to not necessarily discuss with him, but say, well, what does he mean by political decline? What does it mean that the view of the United States as somebody, as a country that's dominant in power, well, maybe that's an interesting insight. And how is it going to work out that now with an American pope, maybe that position, if he, from his point of view, power could be used for benefit of all. You know, there's always two sides to a coin.
We just have a few seconds here, but I'm reflecting. We have a very powerful president of the United States at the moment who is working to remake many parts of society. And now there's this other American who can't be fired, can't easily be intimidated, can't easily be defunded.
Well, it's going to be an interesting relationship, I think, as with would be with any political leader with the church. I mean, that's always a very interesting dynamic to look at and to reflect on and to see how that's going to play out.
Last thing, when you talk with him next time, you're going to call him Robert, Leo, or something else?
Probably because of the fact that for out of respect of the office that he holds, I'll call him Leo.
Excellent. Excellent. Reverend William Lego, thanks very much for your insights. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you for having me.
He's known Pope Leo XIV since sixth grade. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, R. Crumb, the king of underground comics, a famous eccentric, and a musician caught up in the blues and jazz of the past. Crumb created Zap Comics, and characters like Mr. Natural and Fritz the Cat. He's the subject of a new biography. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Today, Russia marked the 80th anniversary of the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Yet another war, the war in Ukraine, served as a backdrop to the event. Joining us to talk about it is NPR's Charles Maines. He was on Red Square this morning, and he joins me now. Good morning.
Morning.
So, Charles, let's start with the parade. What caught your eye this year?
Well, you know, if last year was a fairly stripped down affair, for example, there was just one tank, today was just bigger in every way, not just the hardware, but also the guest list. That included China's Xi Jinping, who was billed as the guest of honor. And it really, the whole thing was designed to showcase Russia's military might. You know, of course, there were plenty of tanks. You can hear them rumbling a bit here. But it was also hard not to notice these massive nuclear missile launchers, which the Kremlin has used not as not so subtle pushback against Western military support to Ukraine, or trucks loaded with aerial drones. These are weapons that have come to define the war in Ukraine for both sides and were making their debut in the parade. But of course, there was also the more familiar Soviet-style aspects to the event, the marching band, the goose-stepping soldiers, more than 11,000 of them, including 100 Chinese soldiers marching along the Russians, quite a sight, as well as a speech by Russian leader Vladimir Putin, who, after all, has presided over this ceremony for the better part of a quarter century.
What did Putin say?
You know, it might be odd to say this was surprising, but Putin really focused his remarks on history and the idea of preserving the memory of the more than 20 million Soviets who gave their lives in the war. So here Putin says these Soviets bequeathed us to defend the motherland, to stay united and firmly defend Russia's national interests, its thousand-year history of culture and traditional values, everything that's dear to us, everything that's sacred. Now, he did pay tribute to China's role against Imperial Japan, perhaps a sign of Beijing's importance to Moscow these days, and of course, Xi's presence. He also said Russia was grateful for the contributions of Western allies towards the victory in World War II. You know, what he didn't do was condemn the West or draw these false parallels between World War II and Russia's current war in Ukraine as one continuous battle against fascism, you know, something he's done repeatedly since he ordered the invasion of Ukraine more than 3 years ago.
That's really interesting. What explains the softer tone?
Well, you know, we can only guess. It might reflect these ongoing negotiations with the Trump administration that are towards not only ending the war, but resuscitating U.S.-Russian relations. It's also perhaps because the visuals, you know, the military hardware, the presence of soldiers currently fighting in Ukraine in the stands and marching on the square, you know, that all supplied the narrative on its own. Mm. You know, it's not hard to make the connection that they had victory then and they want victory now.
As we've already mentioned, it was also well attended by foreign dignitaries, including China.
Yeah, you know, the presence of dignitaries, nearly 30 foreign leaders, including, of course, Xi Jinping, that further amped the stakes for Russia as hosts. You know, making them comfortable meant making the rest of the city miserable. Traffic's been terrible because the police set up roadblocks. But again, this was all in the service of today's event, which I must say went off without a hitch, or it seemed to me.
That's NPR's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
So Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy says he has a plan to overhaul the country's air traffic control system. He cited recent incidents as motivation. First was the mid-air collision near Washington that killed 67 people. Then there was the outage at Newark Airport that left air traffic controllers unable to communicate. NPR's Scott Newman reports.
Secretary Duffy was joined by lawmakers, the heads of the FAA, the National Transportation Safety Board, and the CEOs of major airlines as he made the announcement. He was even joined by President Trump on the phone.
All right, Mr. President, you're on speakerphone.
Hello, everybody. It's a great honor. Great honor.
The administration's plan calls for a top-to-bottom rebuild, new radar and communication systems, upgraded flight management technology, and the replacement of aging towers and support facilities. Duffy displayed decades-old hardware he says is still in use by air traffic controllers. He compared the current system to a flip phone in an age of app-driven smartphones. Stephen Creamer is president and CEO of the Air Traffic Control Association, an industry group that has pushed for upgrading airport systems. He says there's a lot to like about the proposal.
First thing that I like is the level of commitment that's been expressed by the Secretary of Transportation, by the administration. I mean, obviously, we heard the president.
Creamer says he's also encouraged by the level of bipartisan support in the House and Senate and commitment from industry leaders.
I think all of that is what is truly historic about today. The idea that the United States government is going to invest substantially.
Stephen Jacobson is a professor at the University of Illinois who studies aviation risk.
The recognition that the existing system needs to be not just upgraded, but needs to be transformed, I think is critical.
But Jacobson thinks the proposal isn't far-reaching enough. For example, there's been no mention of using artificial intelligence, which could take over such mundane tasks as getting planes away from the gate, something that now requires a controller. He also thinks the administration's announced timeline, 3 to 4 years if the project is fully funded, is wildly optimistic. And notably absent from yesterday's rollout, any price tag for the sweeping plan.
But I have my concerns as well, because this is a pep rally right now, and everybody has the enthusiasm until it comes to Congress and goes into committee, and they have to find the $10, $15, $20 billion that this is going to cost.
And at a time when the administration is all about cutting costs, getting the money needed for such upgrades could still prove a challenge. Scott Newman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
As Swedish author Fredrik Bachman was writing his latest book, he was seriously considering retiring. The demands of promoting his work were taking too much out of him.
Maybe I should go and see if there's something else that I could do that would make me a happier and a little more balanced individual.
I'm Ari Shapiro, Fredrik Bachman, on Feeling Like a Fraud Despite His Success on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The U.S. Supreme Court says former Justice David Souter has died at his home in New Hampshire at the age of 85. Souter was appointed by then-President George H.W. Bush in 1990 and retired in 2009. Preparations are underway for high-level talks between the U.S. and China this weekend in Geneva, Switzerland. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is leading the American delegation. He's characterized the discussions as a precursor to potential negotiations over trade and tariffs. Here's NPR's Emily Fang.
China has said it wants to see, quote, sincerity before the talks, as in it wants the U.S. to drop tariffs ahead of the meeting, which the White House has said outright it's not going to do. Another big challenge is these two countries have very different negotiating styles, and it's not clear to the Chinese what the U.S. want, you know, what the end goals of these tariffs are.
John Prevost says he's proud of his older brother, Cardinal Robert Prevost, who was elected yesterday as the successor to Pope Francis. Pope Leo XIV is a 69-year-old Chicago native and the first American pope. John Prevost recalls what a neighbor once said about his brother.
When he was in first grade, a woman across the street that we used to play with the kids and a woman down the street said he would be the first American pope in first grade.
This is NPR News. The State Department says Secretary of State Marco Rubio has spoken to the leaders of India and Pakistan, urging them to de-escalate their attacks. India has fired missiles and launched drones at Pakistan in response to last month's deadly attack by militants in Indian-controlled Kashmir. That's when more than two dozen people were killed, mostly Hindu tourists. Pakistan denies supporting the militants. As NPR's Dia Hadid reports, Vice President Vance is taking a measured approach to the fighting.
For days now, India and Pakistan have traded blows with drones, projectiles, and military aircraft. They've each targeted areas that haven't been hit in decades. Nearly 50 people have been killed in that fighting. The escalations began after India blamed Pakistan for a militant attack on tourists that separately killed 26 people in late April. Vance spoke to Vox News.
What we can do is try to encourage these folks to de-escalate a little bit, but we're not going to get involved in the middle of a war that's fundamentally none of our business and has nothing to do with America's ability to control it.
He added he expected that the current tensions would not spiral into broader conflict or nuclear war. Dee Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
Stocks on Wall Street opened higher moments ago. The Dow is up 114 points. The Nasdaq is up 97. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. I was listening to the radio yesterday afternoon, NPR, of course, when our colleague Scott Detrow and the rest of the team had the news live that Robert Francis Prevost, an American from Chicago, was the next pope of the Catholic Church, Pope Leo XIV. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose was part of that coverage and has been looking into the life of the pope from Chicago. Hi there, Jason.
Hello.
What do you know about Leo?
Well, Pope Leo is 69 years old, which makes him a bit on the younger side for popes. He was an undergraduate at Villanova University in Pennsylvania, where he majored in mathematics. Like Pope Francis, he's a member of a religious order, in Prevost's case, the Augustinians, who focus on missionary work and education. Prevost, now Pope Leo, went to seminary at the Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, and he did his doctorate here in Rome. He spent significant parts of his ministry in Peru. During his greeting from the balcony overlooking St. Peter's Square yesterday, though, he spoke in both Italian and Spanish, but did not significantly, I think, speak in English. And he served on the Pontifical Commission on Latin America, a place he knows well, given his time in Peru.
What sense do you have at this early moment about what style of pope he might be?
Well, here's what Cardinal Prevost told the Vatican's official news agency prior to his election as pope about what he thinks church leadership should be.
The bishop is not supposed to be a little prince sitting in his kingdom, but rather called authentically to be humble, to be close to the people he serves, to walk with them, to suffer with them, and to look for ways that he can better live the gospel message in the midst of his people.
And Steve, that's very similar to what Pope Francis was fond of saying, that a pastor who's a shepherd should smell like his sheep.
I've noticed that already there are some criticisms of Pope Leo.
That's right. Survivors of clergy sexual abuse say Cardinal Prevost did not do enough to address the issue as a bishop or archbishop or cardinal. But Steve, that's true of many in church leadership. Now the question is how he'll respond to victims going forward and how he handles abusive priests and those who covered up for them. He's also come under criticism for comments on LGBTQ people. Back in 2012, he lamented what he called the culture's sympathy with, quote, the homosexual lifestyle. And he spoke out against a government plan in Peru to teach about gender in public schools. He called promotion of, quote, gender ideology confusing and said such thinking creates genders that don't exist.
I noticed that there are some hardcore supporters of President Trump who seem to assume that he is going to be opposed to President Trump. They're applying that blue-red filter of the United States onto the pontiff. What are his politics to the extent that they're known?
Well, I think that he was a close ally with Pope Francis and as such will probably be willing to stand up to the Trump administration in the same way that the Vatican has for the last dozen years, talking out against the treatment of migrants, talking out against the treatment of people in Gaza and the way the war is being conducted there. So could be somebody who's willing to go head to head and a very prominent American figure willing to go head to head with another prominent American figure, the American president.
Absolutely. Isn't it surprising that it would be an American pope?
Well, I think it's stunning. Prevost's name had come up, of course, because of his position there in the Vatican. He's considered well qualified given his pastoral and administrative experience, but the U.S. is not the center of the Catholic world, and Vatican watchers said the U.S. has enough global power already. And the church, you know, Steve, is far more vibrant in other places, places where it's growing, like in Latin America and Africa and Asia. You know, Pope Francis, in fact, dramatically diversified the College of Cardinals during his papacy to reflect that. So many more cardinals from other parts of the world, but ones who chose an American. It is important to note that while Pope Leo is from the United States, he spent much of his life and ministry outside of the U.S., in Peru and at the Vatican. So he does bring a truly global perspective to the job.
Jason, thanks for your perspective.
You're welcome.
That's NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose.
Many Illinois Catholics are rejoicing at the election of the Pope from Chicago. Member station WBEZ's Anna Sevchenka has more.
Megan Resnicek is a Catholic formation teacher at Everest Academy, a pre-K school in a southwest suburb of Chicago. She was on a field trip with her sixth graders to Chicago's Holy Name Cathedral when they learned that Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost was elected Pope.
While we were inside getting a tour, we heard that the new Pope had been elected, so we quickly turned on the news, and yeah, we're so excited to be here. This is amazing, especially because our new Pope is from Chicago.
How did your students react?
It was just instant excitement, just smiles on everyone's faces. I don't think anyone has stopped smiling for the past like hour since we found out.
That included her student, Max Schultz. He was experiencing the election of a pope for the first time.
I'm just happy that Pope Leo is to be our pope.
If there's something that you could tell him, what would you say?
I would just say that if it would be better if we all unite together and just hope the best for everyone.
Max's mom, Eva Schultz, also tagged along on the field trip. She said she was overjoyed when she learned the new pope was from the United States, let alone the Chicago area.
Especially because it's Chicago, our hometown, so that makes it even more exciting.
Bishop Lawrence Sullivan, the Vicar General for the Archdiocese of Chicago, dropped by the cathedral after hearing the news of Pope Leo's election. He said he's proud that the first American pope hails from the Chicago area. But Sullivan also thinks the pope's nationality doesn't define him.
The people of God are not confined to national boundaries. He is not an American at this point. He's a child of God. And that's the way that he's going to lead, taking all people into consideration.
Although Pope Leo was born in the Chicago area, he's done most of his ministry overseas, like in Peru, where he was a missionary, parish priest, teacher, and bishop, and the Vatican, where he ran the office that selects and manages bishops across the globe. Sullivan says this shows that Pope Leo's ministry will transcend all borders. Father Gregory Sakowitz, the rector of the Holy Name Cathedral, agrees.
Pope Leo XIV, I'm going to say this, I think he's going to be very strong on the immigrant, human rights, and the earth, the care for the earth.
But many Catholics, like Rozenczyk, are also hoping the new pope unites the church at a time of increased political polarization.
You know, it's so easy to be divided in this day and age, to say, I want him to be progressive or I want him to be conservative. I don't believe in politicizing the church, though. I hope he brings unity to the church is probably the biggest thing.
Eva Schultz says she's looking to see more inclusivity.
I'm looking forward to perhaps a little bit more drive towards uniting the youth, bringing youth back to the Catholic Church, including the youth, just like Pope John Paul II did. I feel like he united us, and this is what we need.
As we spoke, the kids beside us started to chant, "Long live the Pope." For NPR News, I'm Anna Savchenko in Chicago.
This is NPR News.
A new podcast explores how soap operas help tell the story of American life, from sexual assault and abortion to AIDS, next time on Here and Now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule, but with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. Animals in the wild usually help out their relatives first, even for social animals that live in groups. But scientists studying flocks of superb starlings over 20 years noticed something different. The songbird often helps unrelated starlings raise their chicks, get extra food, scare off predators. Some parents get help from up to 16 other birds. Maybe it's true for starlings too. It takes a village to raise a child. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Of all the tariffs the United States has imposed on products from around the world, the highest are for products made in China, which has forced companies to ask themselves what really counts as made in China. Jeff Guo from NPR's Planet Money podcast says this is a simple question without a simple answer.
Imagine you're a company making sticky notes. You buy paper, which comes from either Japan or Indonesia. You buy glue, which comes from Taiwan. And then in China, workers cut up the paper, apply the glue, and you've got yourself some sticky notes. Now, here is the million-dollar question these days. What is the country of origin of these sticky notes? Like, what is the official country they come from?
So U.S. law is very unique in its approach to country of origin.
Maureen Thorson is an international trade lawyer. She says companies are often surprised when she explains just how it all works.
You can have products, including fairly sophisticated products, where most of the components and the assembly is all happening in China, but the product is not deemed Chinese under U.S. laws.
U.S. law says that a product's country of origin is based on the place where its parts or ingredients were transformed into something new. The term for this is a substantial transformation. For example, if a company takes avocados from Mexico, brings them to China, and then turns them into guacamole, that is a substantial transformation. Customs would say that company's guacamole is a product of China. But not every example is quite so simple. Over the years, questions about country of origin have gotten pretty confusing.
The complexity of supply chains has grown over time, and that's really what drives the difficulties.
Larry Friedman is a longtime trade lawyer. He co-wrote the textbook on customs law. He says that as manufacturing has gotten more complicated, courts and customs officials have been raising the bar on what counts as a substantial transformation.
Basically, the rule now is that simple assembly, as opposed to more complex assembly, is often not enough to result in a substantial transformation.
That brings us back to our sticky note example, which, by the way, is a real case that Customs looked at several years ago. And what Customs decided was that the final step of the manufacturing process, where the paper and the glue were combined in China, that was not a substantial transformation. So those sticky notes would not count as products of China.
I think they were persuaded by the fact that, what do you use a sticky note for? To write on, like paper, because it's made of paper. So it's the paper that is important here. The stickiness is a bell and whistle to the sticky note, not the essence of the sticky note.
The essence of a product is what tends to matter these days. Here, Customs decided that a sticky note is basically paper. So its country of origin is where that paper was made. In this case, Japan or Indonesia. Recently, Maureen has been helping companies think about changing their manufacturing, so their products are no longer considered made in China. And sometimes, you don't have to move everything out of China, as long as another country is supplying the key component, the essence of the product, whatever that means. Jeff Guo, NPR News.
To learn more about what the labels Made in China and Made in USA mean, listen to the latest episode of Planet Money.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Joy Harjo is an internationally celebrated poet of the Muscogee Nation, and it is with words that she processes this life, joy, hardships, and in a new book, grief. It's called Washing My Mother's Body, A Ceremony for Grief, and it is dedicated to her late mother. When I spoke with Harjo, the 23rd U.S. Poet Laureate, about this work, she started by reading the first lines of her poem.
I never got to wash my mother's body when she died. I return to take care of her in memory. That's how I make peace when things are left undone. I go back and open the door. I step in to make my ritual, to do what should have been done, what needs to be fixed so that my spirit can move on.
Joy, this poem, Washing My Mother's Body, and these first few lines, how did they come to the page for you?
That's always a mystery. That's a mystery with anything, you know? Where does it come from and how does it get there? And I was in the middle of writing something totally, you know, on my father's family and removal from the Southeast and history. And this poem just interrupted and elbowed its way through. And there I was writing about wanting to wash my mother's body, but not allowed the opportunity. And the poem showed me, well, if you couldn't do it in person, you can go back and wash her body in a poem.
Can you describe the importance of that ritual to wash your mother's body before she was laid to rest?
Yeah, it's about acknowledging the story that her spirit inhabited in her body. And it's a way of helping us as well as her to let go. To say, we're here, we walked part of this story with you, and we love you, and we wish you the best on the next part of your journey.
We have something very similar in our tradition. I'm Muslim, and we have something called Ghusl al-Mayyit, the washing of the dead, where you, for purification and respect and dignity and to help with the passing, you wash the body. Going back in time to do the thing that you wanted to do in that moment for your mom, what was that like?
It's interesting how that poem just took over. It was like I was there almost as a witness. I was observing the ritual as it was happening.
Did it give you a closure or something that you needed that you didn't have?
I think it did, and I didn't realize how much I needed that until I had written the poem. It's interesting. We all have, I think, the child's view, especially the daughter's view of the mother, is so potent. And we probably know them more than anyone in some way. But she was beautiful. She was outgoing. She loved to dance. People always came to her for advice. And she had a great compassion. She would look after people. She was a songwriter, but that part of her life was eclipsed when she had four children, one right after the other. And then after the fourth one, was involved in a divorce and became involved with someone very difficult, but she was so lively and had so much energy and so outgoing.
I know that you lost a daughter recently and you did get to wash her body. Going through that as a mother, what was that like?
That was something that was so profound, and I'm writing about it, but there are no words invented yet for losing a child. You know, I think it's important that we are present, that we do not hand over our time and our rituals. It's important to take time to honor in our own ways the lives of those we've lost. And so to be able to stand in a circle around my beloved girl and to do this ritual of washing her body together was profound. And it gave a sense of ritual that there we were together honoring this incredible, brilliant, creative life and acknowledging the gift of her.
And you were able to do for her what you weren't able to do for your mother.
Yes, something I never would have imagined.
Your poem is about the complexity of grief, the relationship of a mother and daughter. the story of your mom. What do you hope readers get from it this Mother's Day and every day?
I guess just to realize that to lose a mother, to lose a daughter, is difficult. And the thing I've been learning with grief is that it's always there. It takes different forms. You may think you've gotten over a hump of it, and then it surprises you.
You said that daughters know their mothers in a different way. What do you mean?
There's something about daughters, a daughter coming from a mother. There's something about that matrilineal link that is so potent. And I remember being there when my first granddaughter was born. There was just something in that whole potent connection that it goes beyond words.
When you finished this poem, you said you kind of got lost in it. Did you come out of it different?
I think so. I was different in the way of understanding how poetry is a tool, not just for poets and readers, but for all of us. So I've encouraged, when I've read it, encouraged people that maybe there's someone that you can't speak to, or, you know, here's Mother's Day. And sometimes our relationships with our mothers and our daughters and granddaughters are so complex. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's good just to sit down and write, it doesn't have to be a poem, you know, write a letter or a story or something. And what I have found in the act of creation, whether it's writing poetry or stories or music, that I open up and I learn things. And sometimes in that process, you come to a greater compassion. You can come to a greater understanding.
Joy Harjo is a poet. She was the 23rd U.S. Poet Laureate. Her new book is Washing My Mother's Body. Thank you so much, Joy.
Thank you, Layla.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.